Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. We start with some debt-related news and facts for the week. We're going to look at a new issue from the New York Times by Gretchen Morgenson called Fair Game. In this play, one role is enough. Meet Brad Miller, a Democratic representative from North Carolina who was elected to Congress in 2002, talks straight and understands how big banks can put consumers at peril. He is worth getting to know, not only because of his deep concern about the foreclosure epidemic, but also because he has made a compelling recommendation to level an exceedingly tilted playing field in mortgage finance. Depending on your perspective, Mr. Miller is either the right man in the right place on Capitol Hill, if you're a consumer, or a threat to the status quo. A lawyer who worked on consumer protection issues in North Carolina, Mr. Miller is not new in battling banks. In March 2009, along with Representative William Della Hunt, a Democrat from Massachusetts, he proposed the creation of an independent consumer agency. It became a part of the recent financial overhaul. This past March, Mr. Miller introduced a bill that would eliminate one of the most pernicious conflicts of interest in banking today, the dueling roles played by the big mortgage servicers. These companies, the biggest are Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citibank, operate as the back office for the mortgage lending industry. In good times, their tasks are fairly simple. They take in monthly mortgage payments and distribute them to whoever owns the loans. In many cases, large institutions like pension funds or mutual funds own the mortgages, and servicers are obligated to act in their interest at all times. When borrowers are defaulting in droves, as they are now, loan servicing becomes much more complex and laborious. Servicers must chase delinquent homeowners for payments and otherwise manage these uneasy relationships, possibly into foreclosure. So, where does the conflict of interest lie? Often, the same bank that services a primary mortgage owned by another institution also owns a second mortgage or home equity line of credit on the same property. When the borrower has trouble meeting both payments, the servicer has an interest in making sure that amounts owed on the second lien, which it owns, continue to be paid even if the first loan, which it has no interest in, slides into delinquency. About two-thirds of primary mortgages are serviced by banks who do not own them but hold the accompanying seconds. This conflict is a crucial reason that the government's loan modification program has been so woefully ineffective. The Treasury Department never forced the second lien holders who service troubled primary mortgages to reduce the amount they are owed by borrowers, even though such a move would give them a better shot at keeping their homes. Of course, the big banks that hold the second liens have little interest in letting borrowers write them off entirely, or in part, because the institutions would have to absorb huge losses on them. As long as the borrower is eking out payments on the second liens, the banks that own them can pretend that they are performing and keep recording them at high values on their books. The top four banks hold approximately $450 billion in second liens that are supposed to take a back seat to the investors who hold the primary mortgages. But because of the front seat role big banks play as servicers, they are in a position to put their interests first. Unless we can make servicers modify mortgages through bankruptcy or eminent domain, the servicers are not going to reduce principal, Mr. Miller said in a recent interview. Their stance does seem largely driven by accounting concerns. They are trying to maintain the fiction that the mortgages are worth the value they are carrying them at on their books. Enter Mr. Miller's bill, the Mortgage Servicing Conflict of Interest Elimination Act. It bars servicers of first loans they do not own from holding any other mortgages on the same property. Mr. Miller's bill has not gained much attention since it was introduced in March, but it ought to, because the Dodd-Frank Financial Overhaul Law is utterly silent on servicer conflicts. The bill would give these institutions a reasonable amount of time to divest themselves either of their servicing businesses or their interest in home mortgages, Mr. Miller said. A likely outcome is that the four biggest banks would spin off their mortgage servicing operations. This would not only resolve the conflict between loan servicers and investors, but it would also result in smaller, less complex banks, he said. That is surely a major benefit. Another is that Mr. Miller's law, if enacted, would break up the logjam now thwarting mortgage modifications. We must reinvent our mortgage finance system, he said. This is a huge part of our economy, and we cannot have a healthy recovery with the housing sector as sick as it is. A member of the House Financial Services Committee, Mr. Miller concedes that he did not see the financial crisis coming. But he said that several years ago, he became aware that increasingly poisonous mortgages were being peddled to consumers. These mortgages were not designed to increase home ownership. They were designed to trap people in debt and strip the equity in their home as home prices appreciated, Mr. Miller said. For the financial industry, the increasing wealth from middle-class homeowners was an attractive target. If they could trap families into a cycle of borrowing every 3 years or so, then a lot of increased wealth in their homes would end up in the financial sector rather than with those families. Mr. Miller recognizes that his is an uphill climb because the big banks have many friends in high places across Washington. Americans have come away from this persuaded that everything has been done to help the banks and not to help them, he said. And in a democracy, that's a real problem. Still, he said he has recently noted a slight shift in the balance of power. I've seen the banks going from losing no fights to losing a few fights, he said. What I found is the more fights we pick, the more success we have. Here's to more fights then, many more. So that's an article by Gretchen Morgenson from the New York Times. In this play, one role is enough. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipczak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we've been studying The Two Income Trap by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyagi, and the story of why middle-class parents are going broke with some breakthrough solutions. And we're actually coming to the end of that study. To start out with, note that the thoughts, ideas, examples, and many of the quotes in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend that you read their books. All Your Worth, and The Two Income Trap. You can also review all of the shows related to this book and all of the debt issues we have discussed over the last several years at the archives for www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt. As I've mentioned many times before, the concept of the two income trap was that a transition happened over the last generation in the economy and the practical result of that transition, where for the most part, mothers joined the workforce in families. Used to be only one person worked and one person in the relationship stayed at home from the generations gone by. But this transition brought, for a time, a benefit of having two incomes come into the family, and then, of course, there seemed to be a lot of extra money at that point. Quickly, the economy readjusted itself and people's thinking changed so that rather than depending on only one income, which in many cases was the primary income to put all of the necessities in, the house, the transportation, the insurance, etc., things that were long-term fixed kinds of payments, or things like food and insurance that would never go away, they started using both incomes to address these budgetary needs. Over a very short period of time, this became more and more the standard, and so we have families that are in what Professor Warren has dubbed the two income trap. There's no safety net if something goes wrong. Well, the shows we have talked about in the past, issues related to the creation of the trap, and feel free to go back into the archives and listen to those shows. We've talked about the allure of how it was all very attractive to have both people working, then the overconsumption myth as the reason for the shift, and then the crisis of not having enough money when some troubles and challenges come up in families. I've also discussed the mother as the all-purpose safety net, the myth of the immoral debtor, the challenge when there was only one parent who was heading a household for whatever reasons, divorce, death, never having been married in the first place, and going it alone in the two-income world that was created. And then, of course, the response by the credit industry to all of these things, including most recently we discussed the creation of the 2005 bankruptcy law, trying to put more obstacles in the way of people filing bankruptcy, which ironically has only marginally panned out on their behalf, trying to get some people into Chapter 13s, which are repayback plans, rather than a straight liquidation bankruptcy. And now we've come to really the culmination of all that thinking and analysis in what Professor Warren and Amelia call the financial fire drill. The primary question here is, how should a family protect itself from the two-income trap? Professor Warren says that the deck is stacked against today's parents who struggle to solve financial problems on their own. One of the primary reasons for that is the bidding wars that were launched a generation ago, where buyers were competing against families who were trying to cut back on spending. There was a generation of layoffs, divorces, spiraling medical costs, and these have hit pretty much everyone. Professor Warren and Amelia offered many suggestions in the two income trap, recommendations for Congress and state legislatures to take collective action, political group action, and faith-based organization action. Also, school districts and community institutions to try to collectively respond to the needs of the family. She concluded that it was her firm belief that collective action is the most effective remedy and that it is essential for reestablishing the economic security middle-class parents so badly need. But she was quite frank, saying that changes do take time and families need to safeguard themselves now. So this is an inquiry into what families should do right now. She started out by saying that everyone raising a family should read a good book on financial planning. And she does not say anything about her own book, All You're Worth, which actually came out after The Two Income Trap. But I highly, highly recommend that book, All You're Worth. It's very practical. It's very simple. There's no complications that are going to get in the way of seeing the problems and dealing with the budgets in a household. She recognized, probably in writing that book, that the most basic premise of all the books that she could find out there are misleading and even dangerous. Those books generally show how to draw up a budget or choose a mutual fund, but in most cases, the advice is aimed only at lucky families for whom work is steady, everyone is healthy, and there are no emergencies. They factor out the challenges. Disasters, a job loss, premature birth, a divorce, all these realistic things that happen to people every day across this country define the financial lives of millions of American families. Unfortunately, that kind of issue is not dealt with in most financial advice books or in most families' financial plans. Her book actually does, All You're Worth. So she uses that analogy that any firefighter will explain that the time to prepare for an emergency is before the house catches on fire. Install smoke detectors, get the oily rags out of the garage, run through a practice fire drill, and do it now when there is no smoke in the air. And personally, being the son of a New York firefighter, I can tell you how invaluable these recommendations are. And what she points out is that the same advice holds for financial protection. Clever parents should run their own financial fire drills. And she asks three basic questions in dealing with the finances. Those questions are, can your family survive without one income, out of the two, that is? Can you downshift the fixed expenses? That's point number two. And then the third question is, what is your emergency backup plan? So those are the financial fire drill questions. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And we're dealing with Professor Warren's financial fire drill questions. So the first one was, can your family survive without one income? So let's look at the facts. If your family is like the average two-income family, then you face a 1 in 16 chance that in any given year, at least one of you will lose your job. Now, if you're a single parent, you actually face smaller odds of a layoff because there's only one person at work. But the consequence of a job loss can be even worse if that sole income disappears, obviously. In either case, the litmus test is the same. Can you survive for 6 months without one of the incomes that you currently rely on? So 6 months, that's the basic projection of a cushion, a safety net. You need to have some money, 6 months worth, stored away if you're a single parent. While if you're a married couple with only one earner currently, then the question is, could the stay-at-home parent enter the job market if something happened to the primary breadwinner and pick up the slack? Regardless of your group, If the answer is no, then it's time for some disaster planning. That leads to the second question. Can you downshift the fixed expenses? If you're having trouble making ends meet, the average financial planning book advises you to pass up those impulse purchases or another dinner out so that you can save more and get out of debt. However, Professor Warren says that the experts have it exactly wrong. If you eliminate all the treats now, while times are good, then where will you cut back when a real financial crisis appears? Take another look at your budget. If you are feeling squeezed during ordinary times, it is likely that you have a much bigger problem than an occasional dinner out or another pair of shoes. You have a problem with your fixed costs. And that really means it's time to take a hard look at the necessities, not the frills. If you're having a difficult time making ends meet now, think about lowering your fixed expenses, the necessities. Can you manage a few more years without a new car? Can you sign up for the lower cost HMO, even if that means shifting the kids to a different pediatrician? Would your toddler be all right in a less expensive preschool? And for most people, this is the toughest question of all. Should you move to a cheaper home when you can manage on a smaller mortgage? These are obviously difficult decisions for any family, but it's better to confront them now, when you have time and flexibility to make reasonable choices, rather than later when the creditors are calling and your back is to the wall. We certainly are very optimistic as Americans, and yet we actually need to balance that out with some practicality and have our feet on the ground looking at things in an honest way. Professor Warren points out that lurking in all of this is a piece of corollary advice to the family shopping for a home. And we've really touched on this quite a lot in past shows. Do not stretch yourself to buy a house you cannot afford. There have been a lot of stories, horror stories, of pressures from brokers and mortgage companies, plus real estate agents trying to sell something and convince a couple that their dream home is available right here, right now. If the only way you can meet the mortgage payments for your dream home is to tighten your belt and commit both incomes, do not do it. That is the essence of the two-income trap problem. The fact that you have been approved for a mortgage is no guarantee, and we've seen that plastered all over the newspapers, that you can actually afford it. And even since this mortgage crisis occurred, there's still a lot of trickery going on in the credit industry. So do not succumb to this false pie in the sky kind of talk that you get from those trying to sell you these mortgage products. Again, just because you're approved for a mortgage is no guarantee that you can actually afford it. As painful as it may be, it's wiser to rent for a few more years or buy a smaller home. That oversized mortgage will leave you with no room for error. And there's a lot of times you need cash for minor emergencies, let alone for a bigger disaster. So don't fall prey to this kind of seduction. Now, Elizabeth Warren was raised in Oklahoma, a middle-class family, and she says that there is a silver lining to all this abstention talk. And here it goes. It's okay to splurge on extras. Now, you would get all kinds of negative responses from overconsumption camp people. But we actually discussed all of that in the past and the myths that are related to the overconsumption camp thinking. Statistics speak louder than anecdotes. The point she raises is that as long as you're staying out of debt and putting something away into savings, and that's critical in her whole mentality, creating savings after every paycheck, you should feel free to buy the kids something new or to treat yourself to a night on the town. If the tough times come, you just drop these expenditures in a heartbeat. No problem. As long as your fixed expenses are low enough that you can manage during a crisis, then you count yourself secure enough to go ahead and have some fun. And then the third point is, what is your emergency backup plan? Now's the time for a painful game of what ifs. What if your husband loses his job? What if grandma's health fails? What if your own health fails? What if you and your spouse split up? Now, the point of this litany is not to send you running for the aspirin bottle, but to help you be prepared if the unthinkable happens. As difficult as it may be, you need to make a plan and to consider what could be done now to make that plan feasible. You have to add a separate line to your budget for these just-in-case safety precautions. The emergency backup plan may cause you to rethink some of your financial commitments. Pay particular attention to timing. Remember, in financing, long-term commitments are the most dangerous kind of commitment. Sometimes they are unavoidable, such as when you buy a home or go to college. But whenever possible, go for a shorter commitment, since that will give you what you need most in times of trouble, flexibility. Now, that does not mean get a home loan for 5 years with a balloon payment rather than a fixed 30-year mortgage. We're talking more about choosing a 36-month car loan instead of a 60-month car loan. And then you add the analysis. If that payment is too high, then heed the warning. You cannot afford this car and you should opt for something cheaper. Once you pay off this car, hang on to it for an extra year or two and keep making payments to yourself. After two or three times around, you can pay for your car in advance, giving yourself that much more flexibility in your budget. It's a great thing. Details may vary on any loan, but think of every long-term commitment in terms of walking a tightrope. So long as your family is on the rope, there is the risk of disaster. Take the shortest walks you can. Another thing is, you should also assess your insurance coverage. Should you purchase a disability insurance policy just in case? Should you beef up your life insurance policy? Talk with your parents about their plans. Can you help them buy long-term care insurance? Perhaps your siblings could help out as well. Long-term care insurance can give several families, your own, your parents, and your siblings, a better chance of surviving financially if your parents need daily assistance. And this is something that's growing across America. Just here in Fairfield and the local areas, there are a number of businesses that are dedicated very successfully to dealing with people in this aged circumstance, but it costs money. When everyone's healthy, the thought of disability can seem like a remote possibility, a bad dream that strikes others that we read about, not busy families with young children. But the fact does remain, medical problems send 750,000 families to the bankruptcy courts each year. So think more about insurance. If you never use it, then count yourself lucky. And we'll stop there for today and continue this final wrap-up in the next week or two. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.